So I'm starting with a kind of fairly broad question, and what does social enterprise mean to you?
I think that it's very difficult to give a straightforward answer to that because there are many different perspectives and many different definitions of what a social enterprise actually is. And I think that in some ways I welcome this, or in many ways I welcome this particular research, because I think that the meaning of social enterprise and the essence of social enterprise really comes from a historical perspective. And to really understand what is happening with social and community enterprises is that you've got to go back into the past and to see its origins and where it came from, and also the pressures for it to develop in particular ways. And I think there are political ideologies that interfere with the different definitions around social enterprise. However, having said that, is that I believe that social enterprises are businesses whose primary and main purpose for existing is to create beneficial social change. Now, that could be benefits directly to a local community in which the social enterprise is based, in which case we would probably define those social enterprises as being the subset, which would be community enterprise. However, the primary or the sole purpose for a social enterprise to exist and what it should be working towards and trying to maximize is social change that is going to benefit a particular target group or a particular community or a particular society more generally. So it shouldn't be seen as an end in itself, social enterprise. It should be seen as a means to an end. And very often, social enterprises get caught up in the delivery of what they think is the service or the production of a product, and quite often lose the social change that they're initially trying to address. And that's why I think that it's essential for social enterprises to examine what is the social need behind what they do, and then keep that very much focused throughout all their activities. And there are many organizations or enterprises that start off describing themselves as social enterprises, but because of the vagaries and pressures within a capitalist society where competition is dominant, is that they finish up, in order to survive, they finish up drifting away from their main social purpose. And I think observers and supporters of social enterprise like myself and others is that we've got to sort of draw people back and say, well, actually, what are you trying to do? And what kind of, what level of social profit are you producing alongside the financial profit that you may be achieving?
That's interesting. You mentioned the kind of yourself and others would provide this definition. Kind of, who else do you think would give me a similar definition to yourself?
I think at the moment in Scotland there are people that have been around perhaps for quite a long time and recognise the tradition of community business and community enterprise in Scotland, and a lot of them are fairly outspoken on social enterprises retaining their main purpose of achieving social community benefit. SenScot is one organisation that is very clear about that. And Aidan and Lawrence would be clear on that, and they have been architects of drawing up the code, the voluntary code in Scotland, which I think is adequate, but in some ways I don't think it goes far enough. And I think that social enterprises have a responsibility not only to achieve social change outwardly to external stakeholders, but also they've got a responsibility to run their organization under a number of values which include fair wages and good conditions for staff, as and generally speaking, having internal objectives that actually possess some kind of social value, and not just try and continue to exist by pushing putting pressure on labour that they're employing, and squeezing that in order to be more competitive in the marketplace.
So for you, the purpose of social enterprise is linked very much to the kind of, with an aim to change society?
Yeah. And that's why I first got interested in community businesses and social enterprises. And interestingly is that my background is in overseas development and in community development, and also I've been involved in teaching abroad. But I was particularly interested in South Africa during the 1980s, before, when it was still an apartheid regime. And lots of people think that the apartheid was to do with the politics or the sort of divisions within society, but the success or the downfall of apartheid and the reason why the black community there actually had more clout and were able to change things politically and socially, and eventually the regime at that time recognised that they would have to dismantle apartheid, was really down to the black community wanting to take charge of their own economic activity. And so for example, during that kind of quiet, or not quiet revolution, but that during that period of anti-apartheid movements within South Africa, the black community started opening shops, it started opening their own supermarkets. Is black community would go to the black shops, the white community that used to own the wealth and generally run the economic activity was under threat. And it illustrated that in order to change society is that you've got to recognize that the economic activity dictates how the social society is structured, and therefore if you can get people to own their own economic activity is that they can start dictating things that are fairer and make create a better society. And for social enterprise, for me, has always a community enterprise was always an alternative way of doing business in order to create social change. It was never just let's work in the marketplace and accept the marketplace and society as being just the way things are done, and then working within that and having some kind of social objectives. That's fine for some organisations that want to be philanthropic, and lots of big businesses are very philanthropic, and there's nothing wrong with that. But social enterprise for me was an alternative way of doing business, and an alternative way of providing goods and services for the benefit of society, and not for the benefit of the select few, that causes greater inequalities and greater divisions within society. So I mean, that is fundamentally why I got involved in this in the first place. It was coming from a community development background. How do we make the society more equal? How do we make change happen that is more equitable for the majority of people? And also, how do we get involved in economic activity to address some of the needs of the most vulnerable in society? So, for example, social enterprise should be about addressing these major issues, and inequality is one. You should be enabling or creating jobs, not for the sake of creating jobs, but we should be looking at, does the job change something in society? Does it mean that people that previously were unemployed can move on? So we're looking not at the creation of jobs as the end result, and employment or the alleviation of unemployment as the end result, but we're looking at social enterprises as creating more more equitable society. So social enterprise for me has always been a means to an end, and if there was another way of doing it, then I would be quite happy to follow that, and campaigning is another way, and that's good, and getting involved in local politics is also another way of changing things. But fundamentally, I think that people will only recognise the change that happens if the economy changes to be more equal. And we should be at the forefront of that as people espousing social enterprises as a means to changing society in a beneficial way.
That's fascinating. I'll come back to a few points you made there, but for now, I would just like to talk about, if you will, about where social enterprise in Scotland came from. You mentioned the kind of rich tradition. Could you tell me a wee bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, my personal involvement in this movement really really only started in 1988. Now, prior to that, there was about 10 years of community businesses in Scotland. So if I just briefly talk about where I think it is come from, and then I can talk more personally from the period 1988 onwards. Really, there's almost like a sort of timeline. And there are a number of things that have happened prior to 1978. There was a co-op movement in Britain. There's a very strong tradition of cooperatives. In Scotland and south of the border, there's been the Fenwick Weavers, there's been the Tullypuddle Martyrs and Rochdale Pioneers and so on. And lots of these particular groups and lots of cooperatives have tried to address the same issues of that social enterprises is trying to address over the years, things like how do we work together and create goods and services in a more equitable and fair way. So we've had consumer cooperatives and retail co-ops and so on. Now, social enterprise for me really comes in the back of our community businesses. Now, back in the 1970s is that there were a number of people that were beginning to think, well, how can we get local people involved in economic activity in order to change or assist in some ways the way that the local community develops. And there were three people in the early 1980s. There was John Pierce, who was based in I'll come back to him, but he originally worked in the Lake District for a number of years under something called the Community Programme. He then moved to Scotland in about 1978 and worked in Paisley for a couple of years, looking at how people in Ferguson Park can take charge of their own economic activity and create more services and create jobs for local people from Ferguson Park. Then there was somebody called Willie Rowe, who was working in Edinburgh, and he was a councillor for Craig Miller. And he was also a community activist in Craig Miller, and he was looking at the development of enterprises, and one of the first was Craig Miller Festival Society. And then there was somebody called George Burt. And George Burt really appeared on the scene in the 1980s, and he has always been involved in community development, but getting more involved in housing and how do you make change. And the three of them were around in the 1980s. The person that I know best is John Pierce, and he, as I say, was working on the community program. Now, the community program was something that was created or set up and supported by the Labour government of Harold Wilson. It was quite an interesting programme, and it started off as a kind of elitist programme, is that they decided that the poverty was getting worse in Britain. The government said, how do we actually change within local communities and peripheral housing estate inner city areas? How do we create change? And the community programme recruited quite a number of people from some of the better universities. And they got them together And they said, you know, this is what we want you to be, community activists in particular places. And these people were young, probably from a fairly sort of left-wing tradition in some ways. They started working in community development programs in some of the worst places across Britain. And what the government didn't recognise is that they would network with each other at the same time. And they then came back to the government after several years, and I'm simplifying this slightly, but came back to the government, and they said, listen, you're always going to have poverty, because what's wrong is the system. And the system is unequal, and it's based around capitalism and competition and the survival of the more stable and so on. And so we're never going to be able to address poverty unless we look structurally at some of the issues. And that wasn't very popular with the governments. And so they disbanded the community program. And a number of these people that worked on the community program are still around. Marjorie Mayo, for example, and Gary Craig. A lot of them resurfaced with the Community Development Journal, which is an academic journal. A lot of them have moved into academia as well. Anyway, John Pierce was an activist that always shunned academia, funnily enough. And he's originally from Cornwall, and he was working in the community program in the Lake District. And then when the community program closed down, is that he had some roots in Scotland through his wife's family, and they moved to West Lothian. And he got a job with LEAP. Now, LEAP was Local Economic Advisory Project, and it was based in Paisley. And there was him, John Pierce, there was Glenn Buchanan, who he recruited. There were a couple of other people. Somebody called McTavish, can't remember his first name just offhand. And somebody that swore all the time, I can't remember his name either. Anyway, they formed a sort of small group of four. Colin Roxburgh is another one, actually. They formed a group working in the LEAP project. And then somebody called Ronald Young, who is the leader of the Labour Howe Regional Council, Strathclyde Regional Council, is that he said, listen, you're doing a fine job in Fergusley Park. In Fergusley Park, is what about extending that and supporting community businesses in other parts of Glasgow? And so he was invited to set up Strathclyde Community Business. And so one of the first community businesses that they supported was Govan Workspace. And there was a fairly seminal meeting where they got lots of people from Govan who were residents in Govan together, and they said, listen, what do you want? And they said, well, let's look at some of the assets in the area. And they saw that a school was closing down at 6 Harmony Row. And an old man, part of the meeting, said, why can't we take over the school and then divide it into separate units? And they can be workspaces, and people setting up their own business and or needing a workshop or whatever can come in, use this workspace development, and it can be like an incubator scheme, so you give them support and so on, and at least then there's some economic activity in the area, because the shipbuilds, of course, were all closing down at the time. And so the first manager was Pat Cassidy, and he's still there at Govan Workspace, so he's seen from a grassroots level the development of community businesses and then social enterprises in Scotland. So that was really, as my understanding, was the origin. Now, I wasn't part of that scene then, but there was a lot of interest around Strathclyde community business and what it was trying to do. So they said, well, listen, can this be a national movement? And so in 1981, informally, Community Business Scotland was set up, and it became incorporated, I think, in 1983. And they got funding from Scottish Enterprise, and also, to a certain degree, Highlands and Islands Enterprise, and it was the HIDB before that, Highlands and Islands Development Board. And the idea of that was to try and expand this idea of community businesses out. Now, running parallel with this is the rural origins of community enterprise and community businesses. And the Highlands and Islands Development Board had a very charismatic and visionary leader in somebody called Sir Kenneth Alexander. And he was the chair of the board of the Highlands and Islands Development Board. And in rural areas and in island communities in the area covered by HIDB is that they were suffering a kind of decline, the stagnation of the local economy. People were moving out and not moving back because there was no jobs and there was no services. Schools were beginning to close down and so on. And so he sent a delegation over to the west coast of Ireland because the west coast of Ireland, they had similar problems now. And a very charismatic priest there had thought up the idea of community co-ops. And they are co-ops that are owned and controlled by local communities. And so the delegation came back to the HIDB and said, listen, let's support this. And so they started a scheme, community co-op scheme, whereby local communities could get together and elect to set up a community-owned co-op, and they would be given £30,000, which in those days was quite a lot of money, to employ a manager. I think it's that that money had to be matched by share issues that were extended to everybody within the local community. So then they would match the HIDB money with a share issue, and they were set up as IPSs, which is Industrial Provident Society, and lots of co-ops have been set up with IPS legal structure. And they were throughout the whole of the Highlands and Islands. Now, a lot of them still exist today in some form or another. Some of them have not survived. The ones that have been most tenacious have been the ones on the island, where community has been very much prescribed by actually the island, the geography of the island. These community co-ops got involved in tourism, setting, running community centres with heritage parks attached. There was one that I visited in Harris that was set up in the early 1980s, and it was employing two people to create kind of imitation artefacts to sell to tourists. And there was a sort of wide range of different things that they were in. Fish farming was quite popular and quite disastrous for a number of community co-ops, most notably Fetlar in Shetland. So they were being set up at the same time, and Strathclyde Community Business and CBS, Community Business Scotland, were saying, well, actually we can learn a lot from what they've been doing as well, and can we put that into an urban setting? And so there were these kind of parallel things going on, and the expansion of community business throughout the 1980s really came about because the Scottish Government had control over urban programme funding. And urban programme funding in England is that they said that you couldn't set up businesses, while the Scottish one were much more liberal in thinking about that. And so they said, well, you can set up community businesses. So George Burt was employed, or sort of semi-employed, to go around and go to particular councils and say, listen, or regional councils that were at those days, not district councils. And they went around the regional councils and said, listen, you need a unit to set up to support community enterprises and community businesses in your particular region. So the idea of development units, similar to the Strathclyde community business model, were set up in every region in Scotland. So there was one in Dumfries and Galloway, the one in Lothian was called Community Enterprise Lothian. It's now, or the successor or ancestor of it is now community enterprise, which is now based in West Lothian, and run by Douglas Westwater. There's one in Grampian called Community Business Grampian. Tor Justad ran one in Central Region. And then in the Highlands, and there was one in Dundee called it's Tayside Community Enterprise Support Unit, I think. And then there was one up in the Highlands. Now, it was funded in a different way because it wasn't urban program funding, and it was funded by Highlands and Islands Enterprise. And it was called Ace High, and Ian Clark ran that one, and he's still around. He runs a private business in IT, but he's still around. Tor's still around, and John Pierce ran the one in Strathclyde. And so throughout the 1980s with these support units is that they had targets, but they could only use urban program money for 7 years with the possibility of an extension of 3 years. And so some of them ran out of their 7 years and then stopped. Others carried on and got funding from different places. Community Enterprise Lothian was one of them. Strathclyde Community Enterprise supported quite a number of community enterprises, and I think the real sort of hub of community businesses at that time was in the west side of Scotland, although it did, you know, have through these development units some support elsewhere. Willie Rowe moved on and set up something called Centre for Employment Initiatives, I think, CEI, and it was based in Edinburgh, and it went bust about 20 years ago, but for a while it was quite influential on, in particular, around employment, and it became a sort of consultancy agency, but it was a non-profit consultancy agency for the sector. George Burke got involved in, after he'd sort of been instrumental in setting up the development units, he got involved in stock transfers, and in those days it was really quite an unpopular thing, is where a social enterprise would take over, or a housing association would take over the ownership of council houses. And he started something called Waverley Housing that was really under the cosh in the media, and he then disappeared off to the northeast of England, and I don't know what happened to him after that. The leader of regional council, Ronald Young, when the regional council was no longer, he disappeared into Eastern Europe and was not seen of or heard of very much after that. John Pierce carried on with Strathclyde Community Business right up until the late 1980s, early 1990s, I think about 1992. And then community businesses were becoming under a lot of criticism in the late 80s, early 90s, particularly the early 90s. I think their heyday was really when 10 years, this booklet, the first 10 years was produced, which is going back, is produced in 1988, is looking back to 1978, and some of the case studies in that are kind of interesting. There also was a directory, and this is 1986 directory, which is looking at community businesses throughout Scotland and in the Highlands and Islands as well. And then I came along in 1988 and I joined Community Business Scotland as a researcher. And what they wanted me to research was six major research elements, and they got 1 year funding from Scottish Enterprise for my post, and they wanted me to look at how community businesses can self-fund. They wanted me to look at how community businesses can assess their impact and the change, the social change that happens, and they wanted me to look at training and how community activists can be trained, but also how managers can be trained in the particular and peculiarities of community business management and support. And so my 1 year resulted in about a whole series of fairly lengthy reports. One resulted in the Scottish Community Enterprise Investment Fund. Now, this fund was took about a year in embryo stages and was eventually launched in 1990 across Scotland. And we decided to raise money through having an ethical share issue, similar to what had been done with ICOF south of the border. And ICOF is... I can't remember what ICOF... It's something fund. Community, not community, maybe collective ownership fund. O is ownership, anyway. And it was a subset of ICOM, which was a collective ownership movement. And we got somebody from ICOF to come up and talk to us about share issues. And it's quite complicated setting up a share issue, because this had to be a public limited company. And to create a PLC, you needed £50,000 in those days. And we got that money from Scottish Enterprise. And then we needed money to actually write prospectus and so on and advertise it. And we were looking at advertising on television, but decided that was too expensive. But we were looking for between £500,000 and £1,000,000 to be raised. And the shares were £200 each. And I bought one, but lots of people bought lots. And there were lots of people south of the border who were looking for ethical investments at the time, and they put their money into this. And so it was launched in 1990, simultaneously across Scotland. It was on the radio, television, did a report on it, and it caused a lot of interest. And over £500,000 was raised at that time, and then it was used to give out understanding loans to community businesses and community enterprises for the next 10 years. The end of the 10 years in the year 2000, it was then disbanded and it was taken over by the charity bank that had been set up by Gordon Brown. And they continued to honour the sort of and collect the interest on the loans and so on. And it supported quite a number of community-based organisations throughout Scotland. So that was one thing that came out of what I did. The other thing was around social accounting. And there was no way at that time of looking at how an organisation that's got as main purpose as social is that there was no system of actually describing what that social change is. And organisations and community businesses were only being assessed on whether or not they're commercially viable, whereas they've been set up in order to create social change. So John Pierce, myself, and one or two others got together and said, you know, we've got to find out more about social accounting and audit. Now, social accounting has a long tradition in the co-op movement. And somebody called Freer Spreckley was very instrumental in that, in the co-op movement. And we borrowed a number of ideas and created a system whereby an organisation can use a kind of logical framework to look at what its main purpose is, to collect information on whether or not it's achieving that purpose and report on that and then get it externally audited in the same way as financial accounts get externally audited. And we thought that's the only cost-effective way of actually doing this. You can assess social benefit but using consultants, but it's really expensive and it's disempowering. So we were looking at social accounting, so that was the other part. And then the other part was training I was looking at. And there were two levels in particular of training. One was how do you train lay boards to run companies, which is essentially what the community enterprise was doing. And it would be a community enterprise or community business would have open membership for everybody within that particular community. All members would then vote on a board of directors from local people, plus some one or two experts from outside, perhaps. That board would then be the company directors, and they would employ a manager in order to manage a community business and employ local people and provide services and particular things. They tended to get involved in community businesses in things that were fairly low skilled, because one of their aims was to employ local unemployed people. So it would be in security companies, building, landscaping, those kind of areas where you employ a lot of people and get local contracts and provide security and landscaping for particular areas, housing also, and cause sort of links with housing associations. So there are sort of multi-functional bodies, community business, getting involved in a number of different activities. Now, a lot of them became charities. And the charity law in Scotland at that time was administered by the Inland Revenue in Scotland, and was much easier to become a charity than doing it in England through the Charities Commission, which was another reason why community businesses in England didn't grow to the same extent. And so somebody called Stephen Phillips, who is a lawyer, who was the lawyer, very young lawyer, who brought this together and helped bring this together, rather, is he was looking at how you can structure a community business so it's able to trade and at the same time have charitable structure, charitable status. So they came up with the idea of having a charitable holding company and then trading subsidiaries that are wholly owned by the charitable holding company. And that meant that the trading arm can then covenant back on an annual basis money back to the charity. So the trading company can employ people and run a business and so on. And that structure was adopted by most community businesses and then laterally by community co-ops as well in Scotland. And we were looking at how organisations, community businesses, can assess what they're doing. And so we created this idea of social accounting and audit. And I'm getting slightly losing my thread here, but the other part was training. So if you've got managers, is that a lot of the managers that were being employed by community businesses came from middle management in private sector companies, and they didn't really take on board the social benefit which was there. So there was a kind of divide at that time in the late 1980s between the people that owned the company, the local directors who were only there really for social purpose, the manager, who often was thought that they were running a small business, and then there was a third group, and that was the development workers who were attached to development units. And I often used to think it was a reflection of class. Now, there's a lot of talk about class, but the development workers were often university graduates working in development units, community development, going out and helping people set up community businesses. The middle managers were often managerial, often maybe a diploma in business studies or something like that, who were very kind of practical and so on. And then you had the lay board of directors from local areas who had worked in, you know, as workers, they were working class. And you had these kind of divide, and the training was often different from each group. The managerial class where, you know, how do you write a business plan and how do you do this? And the development workers were, well, what about your social benefits and your social accounts and so on? And the local people were struggling with the whole concept of what their responsibilities were as directors of a company. So we looked at the sort of training for these three elements in what I was doing and came up with a number of suggestions. And later on, one of the ideas that I think really came from a lot of that was the Social Enterprise Academy, although I don't claim to have very much to do with Social Enterprise Academy, and that came much later on. So the early 1980s, you had this kind of thing happening, trying to support the sector. development units going through periods where their funding was beginning to be under threat because Auburn programme money was coming to an end. And then you had people writing big reports, are community businesses actually working? And there was a fairly big report, well, there was an evaluation in 1988 that I think was done by Pew, Training and Employment Research Unit at the University of Glasgow, and it goes into a lot of detail evaluating the pros and cons of community businesses. But there was a fairly influential report which was led by Keith Hayton in the early 1990s, and this more or less lambasted community businesses, and people were saying, well, they're not cost effective, and they were doing basically a cost benefit analysis. They weren't looking at social benefit particularly, they were looking at survival rates and how much money had gone into it and turnover and so on. But this became the kind of documents that local councils would start waving around. Regional councils were going actually out of favour at the time. And they would say, we're not going to support community businesses anymore. And community business got a bad name, and nobody would use the word community business. And people started using the word community enterprise.
Before we maybe move on to the 1990s and the kind of more those controversies, I want to go back to a comment you made earlier, and you kind of very much thought that the west of Scotland is a kind of hub for community business. So I was wondering if you could expand on that. Why did it seem to work in this particular area, do you think, or why did it become that hub?
I think it's partly because a lot of the communities traditionally provided labour for big businesses. In Lanarkshire, the steel mills, West Lothian with, although that's really on the eastern part of Scotland, but West Lothian with British Leyland, there was the Gartcosh steel mill that closed down, there was the shipbuilding on the Clyde, and in 1979, Margaret Thatcher came in to power on the back of, listen, a lot of these coal mines and shipbuilding and so on, we've got to move on. And in her way of it was that she was a follower of Milton Friedman in the States, which is to cut government and private sector should flourish and provide lots of services and so on. The private sector can provide lots of things for many people, but in areas where there is no economy or a stagnant economy, there's no money to be made for the private sector, so they will not operate in these areas. And so there were whole areas that were just declining, and it was local people that decided, listen, we've got to actually do something about this. And nobody else is going to do anything else, the council's not going to help us, and there's been a long tradition in Scotland of the council. The council's helping out on housing, the council will help us out with jobs, the council will employ, you know, be the main employer in the area. And with all the cuts on the councils, is that you are having a kind of vacuum there, and local people said, activists said, we've got to actually help ourselves. And so that's why I think that community businesses caught on, and particularly in the west, because that's where those areas were most prevalent.
So do you think this is because of a kind of, the community business snapped in because of a market failure, or was it a
Yeah, it's market failure. It was a combination of both, actually. But it's not a failure. It's just a withdrawal. A withdrawal of public subsidies. And generally speaking, there's less and less money being raised in taxes for the amount of services that we traditionally expected post-war. Who pays for these services, I've got no idea, and I think this is indicative of the rise of social enterprises in the last 10 years, is people are moving, private sector or public sector is got less money to spend on the most vulnerable in society. There are also a drain on the money, quite often, is that it's you're spending a lot of money on fewer and fewer people. Lots of communities and groups that are poorer are not going to be able to pay for services. So the private sector doesn't want to move into these areas because there's no profit margin in them. And so you've got a situation of neglect rather than failure. And that's where community businesses got a toehold. And I think that's also where social enterprises has come, because it's very popular with all political parties, because they recognise that they can't provide services, therefore, aha, social enterprises can provide services.
Mm-hmm. And so, would you at this time suggest that there was a distinctive experience of community business in Scotland?
Yeah. And we used to, Community Business Scotland had a staff of maybe about three people, board of directors. It also started CB News in the early, and I think you've got copies in the archive of all of these. It's a huge resource historically, this. Because it goes back to, I think the first one was about mid-1980s, something like that. It then ran for quite a number of years, and then New Sector was set as the successor. And New Sector was printed by a group called Alpha Communications, who are still in existence, Dave Parker. And it was became UK-wide, not just a Community Business Scotland newsletter. One of the editors, or the first editor of CB News, was Kay Caldwell. And I'm just adding names to this list, actually, because she's worth adding to that list. And she started off as the editor of CB News and then New Sector, and then she was the chief executive of CBS, Community Business Scotland, in the mid-1990s. She took over from somebody called Mike Finlayson, who is the chief executive of Fourth Sector at the moment. And he was employed by CBS Network for 3 years. To try and move community businesses through a very rocky period, actually. So that period in the early 1990s was a very difficult period. I was working for I moved from Community Business Scotland, I was working for Community Enterprise Lothian. And I worked a bit with John Pearce on social accounting. And he did a pilot program on social accounting in Lothian. Started off as training officer, then I worked in Wester Hills. And I came across Lawrence DeMarco and Aidan Pia and Jackie Scott and a whole lot of people that worked in, Angus Hardy, a whole lot of people worked in Wester Hills at the time. And Sen Scott was set up, I think, at the end of the 1990s, beginning of the year 2000, and it was a one-person band, really, set up by Lawrence DeMarco, and now Aidan Pier runs it. And in the 1990s, I went abroad for 4 years, actually. I left Scotland and went to Indonesia to work with VSO for 4 years. And then when I came back in 1998, I started again to work with John Pearce on consultancy basis, mainly through CBS, and did a lot of work through CBS. We paid, had a situation where we worked for CBS, but we paid a tithe, a tenth of our daily rate to CBS to keep it going. And CBS got sort of a lot of its functions were taken over by other organisations. Lawrence started SendScot, so that networking system was taken over by them. The funding part, Social Investment Scotland, SIS was started around that time, and CBS thought, well, and SCEF had then moved on to the charity bank. The training part, people were talking about social enterprise academies, and that was going to be taken over by that. In the early 1990s, there was so much sort of antagonism about Strathclyde Community Business, and it lost its political source of power because Ronald Young and the regional council was disbanded and Ronald Young moved away. Is John Pearce's political basis sort of collapsed. So he was edged out of Strathclyde Community Business, and they changed their name to two companies. One was Community Enterprise Funding and Community Enterprise in Strathclyde. And so they tried to separate the funding out from the development support, implying that under Strathclyde Community Business it was too cosy giving funding to community businesses and development support. There was a kind of vested interest in it. So they separated into two companies, then they realised that was didn't work and they disbanded the funding part. Ronnie McPhail, who also was a director of SCEIF, he took over from John Pearce. Ronnie McHale, actually. He took over for a number of years, and CEIS was then, he did it for a number of years, then was taken over by Alistair Grimes, who came from SCVO originally, and he ran it for quite a number of years and then moved on to the Wise Group. And so the period of change in the 1990s was fairly predictable in some ways. Community businesses were going down, there were still people around talking about community enterprises. But then, really coming from Europe, there was a bigger interest in this area of social enterprise. And that really, the term social enterprise, some people think it was coined by somebody in 1998 or whatever, but the idea of local organisations taking charge of the local economic activity and running things for the benefit of their local community and social benefit came out of France with the social economy. It was talked about a lot in Germany. And CBS Network was getting more involved in European projects. And John Pearce in particular was getting drawn into European project. Also Tor Justad was at the same time. He was also a freelance consultant. And because he lost his power base with the development unit. So they started working on social accounting and one of the first projects in Europe to talk about social enterprise was the EPOS project, and I think you've got a copy of the report in the archive there.
So what motivated you to kind of keep working in this area? You mentioned you kind of lived in Indonesia for a while, come back.
Yeah.
What motivated you to keep going in this difficult time?
I came back and Community Enterprise Lothian was still going, CIS was still going. Other people were sort of setting up different things like SenseDot and Unlimited was being set up. There were quite a number of people that were the kind of next generation taking over. And so I came back and I didn't want a job in the sense of having a position. I wanted to work on a freelance basis. And so since 1998 I've been freelance and did a lot of work through CBS and European projects and research projects. And then at the back end of the 1990s I got involved in two European projects. One was called Kipkeza, which was looking at community enterprise development, social accounting and community profiling. And there are two documents which I think you've seen probably.
So why were you particularly interested in working freelance?
That's one of them, getting started, establishing community enterprise. And this one, community economic profiling, which is looking at the needs within local communities. And then the third part of that was social enterprise. I suppose I came back thinking, actually I know quite a lot about this. I have always enjoyed working with John Pierce, and I started to take the crumbs off his plate, off his table, and got more involved in working directly with him. But it was a gradual process.
Okay.
And we talked a lot about social accounting, talked about European work. We also started raising money for projects abroad, and through CBS we supported communities in India and South Africa and in Malawi. And so it was a matter of sort of making a living from having your finger in lots of different pies.
And so how did you describe your work to people at that time? Did you give yourself a particular label, or?
Not particularly, no. Community enterprise researcher is probably the closest that I got. And yeah, it was kind of interesting because there were lots of things sort of happening, and then all these sort of intermediary organisations sprouted up. There was in the mid-1990s a seminal report, which is Community Business Works, which was produced by Simon Clark and Alan McGregor, and it's looking at, or it assesses economically, the economic benefit of community business as opposed to an ILM, an intermediate labour market. And that caused a big stir, and people were starting to re-look at community enterprises and say, well, actually, we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, and actually there's quite a lot of benefits. But there was no way of measuring or assessing impact, and that was one of the problems around that. So it was a kind of sort of bitty time, back end of the 1990s, and early 2000s, but these intermediary organisations started, and there was a lot of them, and there were a lot of people around, and then Martin Mitiard, who's got a very strong connection with co-ops, is that he was instrumental in setting up a cooperative development agency for Scotland. There had been some for some of the regions in the past, and there was one famous one in Edinburgh in the Lothian region. But it came under the auspices, and is still under the auspices, of Scottish Enterprise. So it was actually a unit within Scottish Enterprise. So there's quite a lot happening. CBS carried on. Then discovered that a lot of what we were doing was being taken over by these intermediaries with new government funding. And so we specialised in overseas development and social accounting, really. But at the same time, we wanted to bring all these intermediaries together, because it was crazy having all these different people. We used to host visits from people abroad, and they would be looking and thinking, you know, why are there so many intermediary things with overlapping functions all over the place? So we applied to the lottery and got lottery funding to employ somebody for a year to look at this whole area, and that's Claire Brady was employed. And if you can get a hold of her report, it probably is in the archive, but her final report after, I think, 2 years of funding, she came up with lots of really good ideas on how to build the sector for the future and looking back on the past. She was beginning to bring people together into a kind of coalition. And then we got another 1 year funding for somebody called Emma Hutton, and we employed her to bring the coalition together, and she did that, and although we were employing her, we gave responsibility for her management to the emerging coalition. Kevin Robbie, he also was somebody who was with Fourth Sector, and he very strongly brought the coalition together, and that's now become Social Enterprise Scotland. But CBS did quite a lot of things that we have been unsung about, really. I mean, bringing things together or making things happen and then allowing them to go forward. Similar to how Lawrence and Senscott operate which is to start things up.
Mm. Do you remember any kind of particularly pivotal events like that from that time?
Yeah, it's not a very good one, is that we, Development Trusts Association, that's another intermediary, and the Development Trusts Association didn't come to Scotland until much later on, until that period. But Development Trusts are community businesses or community co-ops. They're anchor organisations within local communities. They've got a much stronger tradition in rural areas than in urban areas. But they didn't have a Development Trusts Association in Scotland because for the whole of the 1980s is that the Development Trusts Association in England recognised in Scotland you had CBS Network. But when we declined, is that we said that actually it makes sense that Development Trusts Association does come to Scotland. So I wrote a brief for consultants to do a feasibility study on setting up DTAS, or Development Trusts Association Scotland. And it never went anywhere. And then it was commandeered by SenseCot. Commandeered is perhaps not the right word. And I can remember them saying, this is what we're going to do. And we had a lunch with Aidan and Lawrence, and there was Alan Tufts and me. And I just suddenly realised, you know, it's the new organisations who are going to take these things forward. CBS, we don't have the clout anymore. And so if you talk to Lawrence, he'll say, oh yeah, they set up the Development Trusts Association in Scotland. Not actually the truth, but they then pushed it forward, and I think that's been one of the success stories in Scotland. Is Angus Hardy used to run it, and it's now run by somebody called Eve Cook, with a development community development background, and they've expanded Development Trust across Scotland, and that's been great actually.
So this kind of idea of networking seems to be a kind of recurrent theme in the different eras of social enterprise in Scotland. I'm wondering, is there a specific type of person that you think kind of works in social enterprise?
I don't think so. I think it takes all sorts of people, but some are better than others, and it's knowing what skills people have. John Pearce was a great networker. And he wrote a lot, and he did things. That's what I liked about him. I liked working with him, because he didn't just chat. Is that he went on and did things. He was very practical, very focused on let's do something here. Even if it's the wrong, you know, it's found to be the wrong thing eventually, is we can tweak it later on, but let's get on and do things. But he, well, you've seen his books. Firstly in the co-op, he wrote a book on how you set up a co-op, so a very practical guide. I can't remember if I've got these books here or not, but he wrote one called Commonwealth, I think. I don't have it actually. Oh yeah, this is it. At the heart of the community economy, and this actually influenced quite a lot of people, and it also sort of projected him as being a kind of thinker in the area of community enterprise and then later social enterprise. Then of course he wrote Anytown in 2003-2004. He also wrote another pamphlet on measuring social wealth, which is very influential, and he loved conferences and going talking to conferences, and which I hate, I don't like at all. And so I was kind of supporter of him, and he was very good at that. A lot of the detailed stuff is that I might have done or helped him with a bit more, because I'm not particularly in that kind of mold. There also, funnily enough, in the late 1990s, is that there was a lot of interest south of the border in community enterprise, and it's partly European funding, and Liverpool Council got heavily involved in area-based development that involved community-owned businesses. And so John Pierce did a lot of work in Liverpool, and I helped him a lot with that. And then we did a lot of work around social accounting in Liverpool. And the first guide was written with Liverpool City Council money. But that came out of some work that was done with the New Economics Foundation in early 1990s. And so there was kind of, in the year 2000, there was a lot of interest, there's different people getting involved in it, people thinking they'd invented social enterprise and so on, and it moved into a kind of fairly fluid area. The Academy was set up in 2003-2004, Social Enterprise in Any Town was set up, there was a big European-funded project on measuring, Prove and Improve it was called. And it was supported by something called Social Enterprise Partnership GB, the impact part of it was run by the New Economics Foundation, and we were part of that, and that led to the creation of a methodology, or a set methodology, for social accounting and audit.
Okay. That's really interesting. I'd like to get maybe just a slightly clearer picture of this kind of scene, if you like. So, as well as John Pierce, kind of who else were you talking to at that time? Were there kind of friends and family, as well as colleagues, that were influential in supporting you in this work?
I don't think many people were supporting me, but I was supporting people, or I'd like to think of all. So, there was John Pierce, myself. And the board, the CBS had a changing board all the time. We had people from, at one stage, Kevin Robbie used to be a member of CBS Network, Martin Metyard, I think, was a member of the board for a while, Rachel Fairley from One World Shop, George Shand, who's now a minister in Jerusalem, I think, Church of Scotland, Emirate in Jerusalem. There were a number of different people all sort of circulating about.
And where would you meet to have these meetings?
I don't know if there was much meeting. Well, CBS met and just carried on. Patrick Bowles, who's still a director of CBS.
So were you very much working as individuals, do you think?
Yeah, but putting a tithe through CBS. But there were only a few of us doing that. It was contractual work, like evaluations that people were wanting to be done. For a period of time, John Pierce and I were very good at getting contracts. In 1999, a friend of mine who runs Blake Stevenson, called Glenys Watt, approached me and said, would I be one of their part-time senior consultants? And so I took over for maternity leave for 9 months. So did that for 9 months with Blake Stevenson. But the other 2 days a week I was trying to juggle other contracts. So it's a funny thing, freelance work. You've got very little security.
And did you find that was it often sometimes difficult to keep going with your work because of that insecurity?
Periods of feeling unconfident about getting contracts in the future. You can occasionally browse the newspapers to see what jobs are out there. But I didn't do that. No. Oh, I think I maybe applied. I think I applied for one job at SCVO once. So I'm very glad I didn't get. But it was the Scottish Council for Voluntary Organisations.
Why are you glad you didn't
Well, my experience of Blake Stevenson was suddenly, this is a personal thing, is that I really valued being in control of my own economic activity. Is that I didn't want a boss. And I found in Blake Stevenson, although the two owners of it were very good friends of mine, is I found it really difficult that I had to be there from 9 o'clock till five, regardless of whether or not I had anything particular to do. I just thought it was a really inefficient way of working. And I generally think that's, lots of people have recognised that, is people would, in the past, would apply for positions, and then once they got their position, they would be there, and they would get their pension, and that would be it. Whereas work doesn't work like that. Work is usually around tasks and people wanting things done. And so contractual work is a much more efficient way of organisations or things being done, so that you've got a beginning, a middle and an end.
And were there other responsibilities that you had that meant that kind of working on a contractual basis was...
Well, it's a bit of sort of, some is paid, some is not paid. I was the treasurer with Community Development Journal for since 1998 until very recently. Still on the board, but I'm no longer the treasurer. And that was all voluntarily. Although you get a stipend of a few hundred pounds a year. But then I met interesting people, and they're all academics, and they're all sort of, you know, community development academic type, and academia is something that's kind of interesting. And then and since the mid-2000s is the academy started, and I started to get work through the academy, and then I became a tutor of the academy, and I still get work through that.
So how much of your work would you describe as kind of talking and doing? You kind of characterise, you know, those people who chat, and those practical people like John Pierce. How have you balanced that in your work?
I'm doing more teaching or training or facilitating or whatever it is nowadays than I used to do. European projects, that's been a mainstay. Also, we set up the social enterprise, the social audit network, and that I'm doing, I'm a voluntary director on that, and I've done a lot of fundraising and so on for them, and lots of projects we've done, and we also supported the setting up of SAN India, and got money from Lloyd's TSB to do that, 3-year funding in the mid-2000s. There was a time when we were going for contracts and getting maybe 2 out of 3, but then we 2 out of 3 is very, very high, but then it dropped off a bit, and we thought, actually, we're putting in a lot of work for competitive tendering, not getting the work, let's not bother with competitive tendering, let's just go for the work that we know we can get, or set up a project that we are interested in doing. And so in India, for example, got lottery funding at the back end of the 1990s to support women's groups. It's very much based on the Muhammad Yunus idea of particularly women setting up savings clubs. So that was all through Kerala to begin with, and then it expanded to Tamil Nadu and two other states. I can't remember the ones. So that involved monitoring visits on a regular basis. And having an overseas development background, I found that really interesting.
Out of all the projects you've done kind of in Scotland and internationally, is there anyone that sticks out as that one really clicked and made exactly the kind of impact you wanted?
Yeah. But a lot of things, if you hung around with John Pierce long enough, you kept on finding yourself a little bit before your time. The setting up of that investment fund, for example, was way before its time. And lots of people don't know anything about that nowadays. But it had a big influence. Community businesses. I do a lot of teaching with the academy. I go in and talk about community businesses, and I said, does anybody remember community businesses? nobody does. And I think that is a pity. But there was one project in the early 2000s that was a research project called Concise. And it was concocted by somebody called Mel Evans at Middlesex University. I don't know if he's a professor now or what he is, but I think he's still in academia. And he put in this application for 3-year funding to research social capital. And what he wanted, or what the design of the project was, and it had been discussed with John Pearson, with somebody called Karl Bilthoser in Berlin, and various other people, somebody called Keane in Barcelona, and somebody called Bose in Sweden, and they'd all got together and said, well, listen, we could set up this project, but it was Mel Evans that actually drew up the proposal, put it in, and got lots of money. I mean, hundreds of thousands of pounds for a 3-year research project. And it was to look at the relationship between social enterprise, which nearly always was community enterprise, but social enterprise was the term that was used in Europe, so the one more likely to succeed. So it was, is there a link between social enterprise and social capital? And do social enterprises support and generate more social capital in an area, but also do they use social capital in the area to set up more social enterprise? And that was the most interesting research project that I've been involved in. And it was interesting because it posed a number of problems, and I think this has direct implications to the work of Bobby and also the work in the case studies and the current MRC funded Commonwealth project at the moment, because it's also looking at the link on more wider society and health of and well-being within a community and social enterprise. And I think that people should go back and look at the final report and go into some of the detail, because what we were doing, or what we had to do at the beginning, was to define social enterprise. And lots of people have done that before, but nobody in such a sort of definitive way has done it, was doing it at that time. So we defined social enterprise. We defined the social economy using that famous circular diagram. And we defined social capital. And we took all the kind of bits and pieces from literature review on what people said about social capital, and we concocted a definition for social capital. So that created the foundations that could then be built upon. And very practically, how do you recognize the link between social enterprise and social capital? And so we decided that the way of assessing that link and whether or not social capital was being used and whether or not it was being generated, was if you get an organisation, a case study, and an organisation that calls itself a social enterprise or a community enterprise, is if they do social accounts, and if they might have 4 objectives that they want to assess, like increased employment in the area, provide services in the area. But if we could add on a social capital objective, then in the course of collecting information, they would be assessing whether or not that social capital objective was being achieved. Now, this would lead to them keeping a set of social accounts which would be beneficial for them, but this would be beneficial for the project. And the social capital objective would be then looking at the kind of impact of the social enterprise on the wider community, and in particular whether or not social capital was being generated and whether or not social capital was being used. Now, the supposition or assumption is that social capital is a good thing, but we established that in saying well-connected communities have better well-being, better health, and better so on, and that's been documented elsewhere. And so we're saying that social enterprises do generate social capital within an area just by the way that they operate, and they also use social capital in the area in the way that they've been set up and how they've done it, so that there was a direct link between them. And that was the Concise project. Now, getting a hold of any of the reports is really difficult. They were on a website, and I noticed the website closed down. So I don't know whether or not they're in the archive, but I have some of them, and that is the last one. That no longer works. And this goes into, this is the final report bringing it all together, contribution of social capital and the social economy to local economic development in Western Europe. And this is the social audits of social, is the consolidated report.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, this is work package 7, there are 6 others. And they used to be on this, but they're, as I say, they're no longer.
This seems like a good point to actually start move on a little bit and maybe talk about kind of.
Do you want a break or a cup of tea or anything? How are we doing for time anyway?
We've still got an hour, I think.
Well, it's 10:30. Okay.
Well, I'm alright.
Yeah, fine.
To think a little bit more about community and kind of the impact of the work that you've been doing. So I was wondering kind of how is our community or the idea of community defined in social enterprise?
Well, this is an area of debate. And it's been debated in the 1980s. It's what do we mean by community? And particularly when you start working abroad, is that you realise in Germany there is no word for community in the same way that it's understood in Britain. And in France, they talk about commune, and it's very much geographical. And it's one of these words that means different things to different people and in different contexts. Some people say, well, there's community, a geographical community, and then there's a community of interest. So everybody on the Facebook, such and such, is a community. And to Germans, they find that really odd. It's a different thing altogether. Also, definitions of what is a community business and what is not a community business is also open to debate. But for SCIF, for social enterprise thing, is that they had to come up with a definition of a social enterprise. So it was community ownership, open membership, democratic control, no distribution of assets, restricted profit use, and community benefit objectives. Now, when I first got involved in community businesses, I didn't really understand what they meant by community. Because if you bring in a community of interest, then you can say a golf club, like Muirfield out there, for a bastion of the establishment, is community business. Because the community of interest is everybody that likes playing golf. And so they are all form membership. They democratically elect in a committee. Committee employs a manager. Manager manages the club and the clubhouse. It's usually not for profit, and most of the money goes back into improving the golf course or its upkeep or whatever. And it's a community business. So what is the special thing about that? Now, if it was to benefit the least well off in the estates around the golf course, then yes, I can see that. But it's to benefit the people that play golf. So this community of interest leads you down paths that actually causes more division within society, or can, and more inequality within society. So personally, I sort of wanted to kick community of interest definition into touch and only talk about geographical communities. And you've got the same thing at the moment with social enterprises. So now people are saying community-based. And I was interested to, Douglas Westwater was asked recently, what was the future of social enterprise? And did he think that in Scotland we'll come full circle and there'll be recognition that there has to be a community link, geographical community link, for a social enterprise to be successful? And he said yes, he thought that was probably the case. Is that this idea of social enterprises without a community link, geographical community link, is a minefield. So community is very difficult. And yeah, I think there is a case for mutual companies though. Like insurance companies and buying things collectively and more having sort of cooperative and democratic rights and so on. Mm-hmm.
And so do you think this idea that was established in the kind of community business days of kind of self-help in the poorest communities, do you think that's possible? Do you think community business and social enterprises being able to initiate that?
Yes, to a degree. I mean, there are problems with community enterprises, though, is that it's the kind of gang hut mentality, which is there are some people in the gang hut and there are some people outside the gang hut, and the people in the gang hut are the ones that are making the decisions for the community, and the people outside feel excluded. So it's not a perfect system by any means, but I think that over the last 10 years there's been a move south of the border to localism. Even UKIP, that MP in his victory speech this morning, is that mentioned about localism. I mean, there is a recognition that in this society where you can get instant access to all sorts of information all over the world at any time, is that local communities should have more say about how they're run and how they're development happens within them. I welcome that. I think it's a good idea, and I think taking over and empowering local communities is good. I'm slightly disturbed that it's been hijacked by UKIP. I thought it was going to be hijacked by the SNP, but they, the most centrist government ever, in my view, in Scotland, and take a very politically want a controlling aspect much more than they should. Now they've got an empowerment bill going through Parliament or Scottish Government at the moment, but it's not as powerful as it could be to allow subsidiarity.
And do you think that's been a key part of your work, the idea of empowerment?
Yeah. So social accounting is all about empowering organisations to take control of what they are measuring and what they are. What change is happening, and having some say in what the change is that they're trying to address. It's all about empowering people. So many people are disempowered. And if you broaden that out, I was a student in the 1970s. We didn't have a particular political power or anything as students, but we had a lot more power over our future and what we could do. And so you have a situation where, you know, half the student population of Aberdeen University sort of went off and wandered around India and bought camper vans and travelled to Greece to live in caves and so on. That empowerment doesn't happen nowadays because of poverty. And there are two reasons for poverty. And that I see it at the moment, and one is the squeeze on wages. Wages are very small at the moment for lots of people. So people are coming out of university along with the other 50% of young people, and they're all getting jobs in retail, which is not very well paid, and hospitality, and 0 hours contracts, and so on. So there's something about wages that is not going up. Now, since the recent collapse and the credit crunch, as they talk about, is wages have not really gone up anywhere like inflation. And that's one side of it, less money around to pay people. But the other side of it is debt. And people get into debt very quickly. And we're creating a society where young people are going to have to pay for their education or their further education, immediately get into debt. They then are expected to buy a house, immediately get into more debt. And if you want to control a population and not have a people sort of rioting on the streets, is get them into debt. Because then you can actually control them. And they're not going to go on strike, they're not going to join the unions. They're going to just make sure that they've got enough money to pay off some of the debt. And if you can keep them in for longer, then that's great. And so credit cards, very easy to get, very easy to go into debt on them. It's a matter of control and disempowering the population.
And so that's very interesting. I'm wondering if, you know, from the time you started in community business until now, this idea of empowering people, has that taken different forms practically? You know, what have people needed help with, and how have you tried to empower them?
Well, I think lots of people, the legalities and managing money of community businesses has been challenging for people that have never done that before, and they become suddenly a board member of a community business. And that document by Keith Hayton talks about all kinds of collapses of community businesses. One notable one was in Barrowfield in about 1990. And it was a big community business run and owned and controlled by local people, and then two of them absconded with half the money. These things might happen anyway, but the community businesses got kind of blamed. And lots of people that weren't used to dealing with a lot of money and a lot of legal things found themselves in positions where the temptation was too much and it was quite difficult. And so empowering people through knowledge and information and assistance and support and mentoring and help who are not used to dealing with things like that has been an important one. I think also more recently, I'm slightly concerned that social enterprise is seen as any other business, and we've had banks getting particularly in on the scene of supporting community businesses or social enterprises with a kind of standard template for business planning. And often people will write business plans paying only lip service to the reason why they've been set up in the first place, which was social purpose. And so a lot of the business plan templates are all about businesses. And so recently I've been working to try and get people to adopt a different business plan, a social enterprise plan that will help people actually maintain the prominence of what their social purpose is about.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering a bit, following on from that, what has been, in your experience, you know, you've mentioned that has sometimes been difficult to manage this relationship between kind of community developers, managers of community business, and the people on the boards. What type of people use the social enterprises or community businesses that you've been involved in? Who have been the beneficiaries of this?
Well, I think in community enterprise it was very much community based. So you know, Bragg and Fife, for example, has a particular catchment area, if you like, or area for development, and that's happened quite a lot with community enterprises. When you broaden it out into social enterprise, is that without a particular community orientation, is that you begin to think, well, actually, is this right here? For example, there is something called Social Bite, which is in Rose Street, and the guy sets up his social enterprise, and you know, his reason to exist is to employ a certain proportion of people that have learning difficulties or whatever, is my understanding. There have been lots of muddying of the waters of that. For example, with social firms, they started off addressing the needs of disabled people. And then they said, it's not only disabled people, it's people that have been long-term unemployed as well. So is anybody vulnerable? So a social firm became just like any other social enterprise. And it was addressing the social need as being unemployment. But then as soon as, and fourth sector was very similar to that, but as soon as it has to compete in the marketplace with efficiencies and so on, without really explaining what the social purpose is it's very easy to drop that social profit, and you finish up just running a business like any other business. Take the academy up with down the stairs here, is that they will say that there's a social enterprise, and to an extent it is, because it's non-profit distributing, so nobody benefits, got voluntary board of directors, but it measures its success in its growth. And it's turnover. And I'm going, well, that's all very nice. It's interesting that your turnover and your growth, but I'm much more interested in the change that's happened as a result of what you do, not on your financial turnover. And so I think more than ever before, there's a need for social accounting in some way. And I mean that with a small s and a small a and a small a. So it's not particularly a method, one method saying social accounting and audit is prescribed, is that people have got to account for their social impact much more.
Mm-hmm. And can you remember working with a group or a community that kind of made you feel differently about community business or social enterprise?
Not as such. I mean, there's been a lot of often high profile organizations that you just think, well, actually, what does that mean and what change has happened? So Impact Arts, lots of good things coming out of it, but it's a bit like sort of catching eels, is that they slip away sometimes, and I'm not quite sure what is happening, and it often depends on the person who is at the top. There's a huge dependency on individuals within business. This word entrepreneur is, and some people describe themselves as social entrepreneurs, is that there is a kind of tension between the individual and the collective. And whereas community enterprises and community development is very much around the collective, the social responsibility to the wider whole, the commonwealth, the cooperative role based around that. In social enterprise, what I find disturbing at the moment is that the emphasis on leadership, and you can't go anywhere on the internet without stumbling over some kind of website on leadership. And leadership is leaders of the community and so on. And lots of people define that in different ways. Jackie Scott, who I worked with after John Pierce stopped working, she did a lot of training or facilitating around leadership. But she would define leadership as much more of a collective leadership and a benevolent leadership, enabling people to, you know, do things. Whereas others see themselves as the sort of, you know, the driver and the single person that is actually driving things forward to make change happen. And I must say I get quite frustrated and slightly annoyed with this emphasis on the individual. I'm much more interested in how people work together than showing leadership. But it's indicative of our society. We're no longer We don't have this idea of the classes is no longer sort of used as a way of analysing society. It's all about consumerism, and it's all about sort of individuals and individual consumers.
And so how would you see the relationship between social enterprise and community development?
Well, it's funny about that, because being part of the Community Development Journal is that if I ever mentioned social enterprise at any of the meetings, there'd be sighs and people sort of, you know, seeing social enterprises as the first tip of the wedge into destruction of the public sector. And the state having less and less control, because social enterprises are just are going to come in and then they'll go out of business, and private companies will take over, and we will no longer have this idea that taxes are for the benefit of all, but that taxes will be used to sort of benefit individual companies and they make profit from it. And we're having this with the dismantlement of the NHS, particularly south of the border, but it's going to come to Scotland as well. And so that's going to happen. And these CDJ people would go, social enterprise is just the end of the wedge. And I would always take a kind of left-wing view of social enterprise, which is changing into alternative ways of doing things. And we've got to find social enterprise or socialist ways of doing things rather than of exchanging goods and services rather than capitalist ways of doing things. And that was kind of accepted to a certain extent within the CDJ, but there are many different factions within the social enterprise sector, and the one that is prevalent at the moment is, you know, with a few social objectives, you can call yourself a social enterprise and take over managing some kind of contract on behalf of the NHS and make people quite a lot of money out of it.
So do you think social enterprises currently help the poorest people in society?
I mean, some do and some don't, and there are lots of examples of really good things happening.
Can you think of an example just now?
I think Bragg Enterprise used to be quite good. I'm not sure sort of most recently. There's lots of voluntary organisations that have been doing really good work, and they're moving into more of a trading aspect. And looking at how they can be more sustainable. I think most of the ones that have assets are more likely to survive. And like the Engine Shed, if they've got no assets, they rent their building from the council, and that's been one of the problems. And they've put a lot of effort into doing it up and renovating it and so on. They're going to lose all of that by closing down. They were doing a lot of really good work, but with few people, and that's been one of the problems, actually, is that it's not having as big an impact as it could have. Kibble has a lot of impact on a small number of people as well. A lot of the development trusts, I think, are doing really good things, and the area that they are, a lot of the rural ones are moving into, is community energy. And this is extraordinary expansion at the moment, I think, is all these wind farms that are being set up from Shetland to every particular island is looking at wind farms, and it's often in conjunction with private sector company, but it means that the community, if they tolerate the wind farm, will get a proportion of the profit coming back to them, which means that they have quite a significant amount of money per head of population to spend on community development within that area. So that's an expanding area. There's lots of ones that are looking at belonging and social capital type things in areas, heritage and looking at vulnerable parts of society like elderly people that's expanding, and young people with the huge expansion in social enterprises around childcare. All these, I think, are doing lots of good things.
Mm. So
they're not very good at explaining it, that's the problem.
Has the ways in which, what areas of people's lives has social enterprise kind of intervened in?
Well, I think that the community based ones is that they have had quite a significant impact on people that have been employed, people that have been involved, directors, and so on. Particularly the ones that have been around a long time. Like Govan Workspace, for example, Bragg Enterprise. So, I mean, the impact has been wide, but the organisations need to describe that and track that. Otherwise they'll lose it. It's like history. Is if you lose your history, you lose your, you become disempowered. You become just a single individual in a sea of different influences. So.
And what kind of social problems do you think?
Can we just have a wee break, actually? I think I'm ranting and raving a little bit, and I want to...
Thank you. My next thing I'd like to talk about is, have the goals of social enterprise that you're involved in changed over time?
Well, it's the one that we've been talking about, which is things were very much on a community basis, and so community benefit. And our social enterprises have changed into sort of, you know, working with a particular target group or an ethnic minority or whatever. And so that's changed over time.
Why do you think that's been?
I think that one of the driving things behind the creation of social enterprises has been, well, there's the historical one that we've been talking about. But the other one is that a lack of ability of government's services to be provided has left opportunities there, or people to take over that opportunity. And lots of voluntary organisations have, in a bid to become more independent or to service the needs as defined by the public sector, have taken on contracts for public sector services. And this is a huge thing at the moment with the NHS and procurement in Scotland. And what I think lots of people in government think is that if an organisation takes this over, then we won't need to pay them as much. Now, partly they won't need to pay so much if they were delivering it, because they don't need to sort of pay their pensions and employ people and all the sort of extra costs associated with recruitment and employment. And so therefore they contract that out to social enterprises. And the voluntary sector is used to get support just, you know, because they were doing good things. And now it's much more on a contractual basis and service level agreements and so on. So the voluntary sector, his voluntary organisations have moved into this area of social enterprise in the provision of services. And so that's changed the landscape dramatically. Another thing that's changed the landscape is social investment. It's where is the money going to come for these things? And there are lots of clever people, particularly in London, who are thinking, and in North America, are thinking up schemes of using public, private sector money in order to support the production or the provision of social services. And I think that is beset with problems, actually. And I'm very wary about any social investors in any form. And I'm not sure that they really thought it through. And they also, I think that they quite often then, payment is by results, and how do you measure these results, and what about the results that you can't measure or that's very difficult to measure, how do you deal with things like that?
So for you, what would be a preferable source of funding?
I'm not sure that there is, actually. I mean, if you look historically, is that a lot of the welfare state that was set up post-Second World War was partly coming from a feeling of an increased social capital that came from the war. Everybody was in it together and, you know, they wanted to come out of it. And that's one of the reasons that really Winston Churchill at the end, the Conservatives at the end, they voted Labour. It was a feeling that we're part of a sort of entity. But it's partly on the back of an empire. So we had companies that were based in the UK, BP and ICI and so on, and they were extracting a lot of the wealth from parts of the empire, parts of the Commonwealth, and they continued to do that. And they were getting taxed by governments. And governments were saying, yeah, you're based in this country, and they would pay their taxes. And so the actual money available for the provision of the welfare state was phenomenal. And we've wanted to maintain that, but the companies are much cleverer at not paying tax anymore. And so they're moving money around and registering different places and not paying taxes and falling between two stools of, you know, not paying taxes here, not paying taxes there. And so the actual amount of money available to governments is no longer as great as it used to. And then you're having more and more pressure on the public on public services. Like the NHS has got more pressure on it. People are getting older. There are more ways of keeping people alive than there used to be. You've got an expanding population in some cases. And so we no longer have the ability to provide services at that level. So you could say, well, we should tax people more. And that's a difficult one because it's very unpopular with political parties. But we're getting taxed in all sorts of different ways. Like, for example, utilities. Have you read that article? There's an article that was written quite recently about hidden tax. But it's not only tax from government, but it's tax by the private sector. Because utilities, if they've got a monopoly, which they generally do, is that they can keep on putting up prices. So it's like a tax we're paying just to have our electricity, which we would now regard as a necessity. So we're actually paying more and more out to private companies that are quite often avoiding paying tax back into the general pool. And so I'm sort of quite pessimistic about what will happen eventually.
Thinking about the impact that social enterprises have, how do you measure the impact?
Yeah, well, I think, and this is an area that I've been sort of around for many years, is that people use it fairly glibly, this word impact. It's actually quite difficult. And it's used in different ways as well. And we, in Social Orbit Network, have defined what we say is impact, is that it's usually the change that happens as a result of what you've done, but on the wider community or society more generally. And so, therefore, if you're training people to get jobs, then the outcome may be a job for the person, therefore, but not necessarily a job. It might be they have more money, there's more less inequality, and so on. But the impact is the society has more people who are more equal and more able to reduce the unemployment in the area and so on. So, but it's actually very hard to do that because it's very hard to attribute the change all the way along that line to something that you've done farther back in the line, and it's therefore glibly used and very hard to do. You can measure outputs usually, and you can assess and interpret outcomes and describe outcomes, and you can speculate about the wider impact. Measuring it as you would measuring the length of this board is really difficult to do.
In your experience, what kinds of things have worked best in order to kind of unravel that problem?
You mean what techniques? Well, I think social accounting is what works best, because it helps an organisation understand more fully what it's doing, and it can then help with managerial decisions and strategic decisions about what it should be doing more of or less of. And it's basing decisions on hard evidence in the main, but also on the direction which you want to go. So, for example, if your mission is to improve the well-being of people within a particular area, how do you do that? You might do it by a number of different ways. Then you say, okay, these are what the ways that we've done. These are the kind of outputs coming from that, like a training course or a childcare facility or this or that or something like that. And then what changes happen for people? Okay, they're slightly better off. They're addressing some of the problems of lack of services and so on. What's the wider impact? Healthier and more well-being community, possibly. But it doesn't mean to say because you can't measure it that you shouldn't do something about it. And lots of people, and particularly accountants, will say, I can't measure it, I can't manage it. This is the sort of mantra, or not at the moment, but it's I've heard it a few times just recently. I said, well, that's rubbish. We are managing things all the time that we can't measure. Like going for a long walk with the West Highland Way. I mean, what does that mean for some people? It means huge amounts for some people, or the outdoors, or a beautiful scene, or a company of friends, or a family party, or love of children, or something like that. And we're managing our life around all these things that we can't measure. Because how do you measure a beautiful scene? And is that even important? Mm-hmm. And so your priorities are quite sort of, you know, to do with your priorities. And you're managing priorities all the time.
And do you think this this pressure to measure impact has increased over time? You know, was there pressure in the kind of community business days to measure what you were doing?
Well, we never used the word measure. We had to account for it, which is not necessarily the same thing. Measurement came recently, and it's a sort of indicative of the wider society wanting everything to be sort of in numbers, or we've been taken over by accountants basically, and they're very keen on in accounting for things in financial terms, hence the rise of SROI. Oh yeah, there's lots of things that we can't measure, therefore we will create a system that will enable us to measure them, so we'll give them a financial value. So you're thinking, well, that's okay up to a point, but appreciating family life, how do you measure that? It's kind of unnecessary cul-de-sac to go down. Yeah, what's much more important is putting a value on that, and that value differs for different people. And then you're recognising that these things are really valuable. Your health, for example. How do you... Economists are, well... Some economists, not all health economists, can't measure health. I mean, what's the point of that? Value it, yes, account for it or explain it alongside other things and prioritise it, but what's the point of measuring it?
So how in your days back in the 1980s would you have accounted for the you know, what would you have been accounting for when you analysed the
social change? So, there is this, which is, I'm sure you've got in the archive as well, which is one of the first things about social, they call it social auditing in those days, and community benefit. And this was written, I think, in about 1988. But, for example, is that what's interesting is that they've got seven objectives, and so you might be an organization that chooses maybe two of them or something like that, and then you're saying, okay, what are these the kinds of questions you might want to ask? What's the cost of that, which is not necessarily in financial terms, but what needs to be done, and then value to society. And so we were attempting to try and look at the change that happens. We didn't use outputs and inputs, outputs and outcomes in those days, but we were trying to sort of explain it in those ways. I just think that lots of organizations are getting a lot out of it by going through the process of trying to see what they're doing and reasserting and reaffirming their overall purpose and keeping track and not drifting their mission into being something else. And funnily enough, one of the areas where I think social accounting has become particularly important is in fair trade. The better fair trade organisations account for social change much better, because they have to, because they could easily slip into being just another broker that is buying things cheap abroad and selling them for expensive in this country.
Mm-hmm. So when you were trying to start up the idea of kind of social accounting, or kind of develop the idea of that, were you working with community businesses to try and encourage them to do this? Yeah. How did you do that?
Well, that's been our downfall and our strength. Social accounting and audit came out of working with organisations. And so it wasn't something that people thought up in a university and then said, right, we'll apply it to everybody. Is that it came from some things worked and some things didn't, and some people got better at explaining what they were doing and some people didn't, and the reports were the reports. So you've got stacks of social accounts, some that are pretty awful, some that are okay, but they are the organisation's report. They're not some outsider's report. And if organisations get better and better at getting sharper and sharper about what they're actually trying to do, and I think that's important, actually. It's a cycle of reviewing and reflecting on what you do and moving on and taking decisions on the basis of that.
Mm. Can you remember any particular organisations that were very good at doing that kind of thing?
I've often asked that, actually. I mean, there was an organisation, well, still is an organisation called SES down in Sunderland. And its social accounts were, you know, if you could get them, we're rid of all the dross that they wrote about themselves and got down to the specific things that they did, is that it would have been a lot better. But they insisted on writing elaborate, long reports rather than being short, sharp reports. I've been working with one employee-owned company up in Inverness recently, Highland Home Carers, and their social accounts have got better and better. Shared interest, fair trade organisation, their one's getting better and better. Because they're focusing on change, social change, and not focusing on just kind of outputs.
And in the, thinking back to the earlier years, were there any organisations that you worked with that you remember kind of thinking, wow, that's really helped me clarify my thinking on social accounting?
Lots of the Liverpool, a lot of the early work was in Liverpool, and lots of the Liverpudlian organisations that were supported by European funding kept social accounts. The problem is that a lot of them don't exist anymore. Some of them do. Housing associations, they're an area that are having to get better and better at accounting for social change. And they've played around with SROI and realised that it doesn't actually help them manage their organisation very well strategically or on a day-to-day basis. And so they're moving into a kind of area which is partly using financial proxies and partly not. City West Housing Association in the northwest of England has written a set of social council I think are very good. And housing associations are interesting because they now have, they're not just managing the repair and maintenance of houses, but they're looking at the wider impact on society, and I think that's a good thing. You know, how did that particular community in Hardwick or whatever, how does it improve the life and well-being of people in the area? And so this, to go back to the MRC project, is that I think there's huge areas there that people can, that the project could learn from, particularly around housing associations. And they would say that they're working towards health in the area too.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever find any organisations that were kind of just very resistant to the idea of going through this process of social accounting?
People on principle, no. But they say, well, it's a lot of work and it's time and resources, which it is to a certain extent, but it should be what you're doing because you put a lot of time and resources into your financial accounts. Quite often have a finance director, a bookkeeper, a financial auditor, and if you add all that up, it might be what, I don't know, 10% of the overall turnover is just in keeping financial accounts, which is not the main reason you're around. You've got to keep financial accounts. You should be putting about the same amount of money into your social accounts, or even more, because that's primarily what you're about. And if we did, is that we would be in a much stronger position to actually explain what are the real changes and benefits of a social enterprise. And at the moment, we're not so good on that.
Do you have any hunches on what you think is distinctive about what social enterprise brings?
I think that what it's brought out is a lot more private sector companies recognising that they've got corporate social responsibility, regardless of whether or not they recognise it or not. That the recognition of that is much more mainstream than it was 20 years ago. It was slightly odd 20 years ago to have social responsibility. Now, private sector companies of all sorts are now recognising that they have an impact on society more generally. I think that's a good thing. But whether or not they're social enterprises, I would say no. But and they wouldn't need to be social enterprises. But and then you've got lots of social enterprises at the moment that are aping the private sector anyway. It's all this corporate speak that you get out of the mouths of so-called social entrepreneurs that really is scary. And you think, oh, just a minute. You know, you're not just running a business here, you're running a business for a social end.
Hmm. And so I have a question that we've kind of hinted at before, but do you think political support is a help or a hindrance for a social enterprise?
Well, again, it's one of these ones, in some cases yes, in some cases no. Like, there are some people in the Green Party that understand social enterprises, I think, very well and very clearly. And but there are some politicians that don't really understand it at all. And yet they both would be supportive, if you know what I mean. Case in point is social return on investment came from nowhere to be the dominant way of describing and accounting for social change within social enterprises. Well, it's completely, in my view, it's an inappropriate tool. It's got its place in cost-benefit analysis to help in decision-making, but it should not have been applied to all social enterprises. And yet there was a director of finance of the when the Labour Party were in power, and certain people spoke to him and said, you know, this is what we can do. We can now explain social impact in financial terms. And he was an accountant. I don't remember his name, actually. In Scotland. Scottish Parliament. And he said, oh yeah, great. And we'll put money into that. And put a whole heap of money into SROI. And everybody was talking about SROI. And that political support, it's possibly a good thing, but it was completely inappropriate to put it into SROI, and it confused everybody, and the fallout from that is still happening at the moment. I'm not saying that social accounting should have been in receipt of that, but at least just thinking and understanding a little bit more about what SROI was would have actually helped things.
And do you feel that there was political support for community business back in the...
Well, there was amongst the regions, but then when the regions stopped and the European, the urban programme money stopped, then there wasn't particular support for that. But and then there was a backlash against it with the Hayton report and other people saying, just a minute. And then there were collapses like Barrowfield and Fergusley Park. Half the board of directors got into trouble for corruption and all sorts of different things. So, but a lot of over time is there's constant baby getting thrown out with the bathwater and somebody reacting in a knee-jerk way without actually looking at the broader picture.
Mm-hmm. And so what issues do you think are social enterprises facing today?
Well, I was just thinking, just talking about this, there's a number of one. One is about the definition, and I don't want to go into that because we've already gone into that quite a lot, but I mean, at this time, being unable to say what a social enterprise is crazy. So, and I think people should just say, this is what a social enterprise is, and if you don't match that criteria, then don't try and change the criteria, just go somewhere else. Call yourself something else. The second one is the left-wing and right-wing social enterprises. You know, why? What is the reason for setting these things up, and what is the need that's being addressed? And are you trying to change the society into more socialist and more equal society, or are you just aping the private sector and running a business with one or two social objectives? There is a kind of wider issue about the tradition and the role of government, and I think that we have in Britain, we have always had a strong state sector, and we've paid taxes into the state, and we've had, you know, the sort of going back to the Magna Carta in England. Declaration of our growth, the kind of nation building, and then you had the welfare state being created to get away from this kind of charitable inequalities that were happening in philanthropy and so on pre-war, and you had a strong state, and that's been reflected in states throughout Europe. In North America, you never had a strong state. Is that it was always seen by North Americans as being slightly a hindrance to development. And that's fine in growth. But when you're not growing, or when your inequality is getting wider and wider, is who is going to look after the 1 in 30, I heard recently, 1 in 30 children have experienced poverty in the United States. That's a huge proportion. Homelessness in the United States, which came out recently. I mean, there's more and more divides in society there. Yet, people who are looking at social change in this country quite often are looking to the United States as being a model that we want to sort of emulate, and we shouldn't be. We should be looking more to Europe. And I think that The problem with looking to North America is because it's easier, because they're speaking the same language, or lots of the papers are in the same language, they're more accessible, more easy to understand, and so on. But if you ever go to the United States, I've only been once, is I was staggered at how different it was. And somebody said to me, everybody speaks English that you'll meet, but don't forget it's completely different. And it is completely different. I have attitudes to politics and race and society and community and so on. It's quite different there. And so I think that there's the, looking to the future, we should be looking more to Europe and less to the United States. The whole area of this social investment is coming from the States. Is a way of the rich and famous and people that have got money pouring out of their pockets, is how are they going to invest that money? And they could be investing it. Investment opportunities is something that's driving it rather than social need. And I think that's a problem. There is an area of means to an end, and that's that triangle where if you're a social enterprise, your economic activity is in the centre, and your change is environment, on people and on society. And I think that the triple bottom line that is usually espoused is you're having an impact on people, you're having an impact on environment, and you're having an impact on the economy, is wrong, and that's taken us completely down the wrong route. And we're then seeing the economy and the creation of jobs and so on as a means to an end and not an end in itself. And where the economy and economic activity lies and is in the middle. And what we should be doing is to say, well, we're actually creating jobs in order for to address some of the inequalities within society. And so therefore I think that that is important and one of the issues. And then ultimately, I question whether or not social enterprises work, and whether or not you can do what they're expecting, or some people are, particularly politicians, are expecting to do, is to create not only a financial profit that can improve sustainability and grow, and at the same time maximise social profit. Don't think you can. You've got to choose one or the other. And then there's possibly localism, and I mean that in not the act in south of the border, but just and this is happening politically at the moment. I'm going to make enemies saying this, but both UKIP and the SNP are symptoms of that, is a kind of retrenchment of values into an area, and particularly in this case it's nationalism, but in both cases it's nationalism, and I think nationalism is really dangerous. I think it's xenophobic eventually, and that's really tricky. And I was scary at the 1 week before the referendum, and thought, dearie me, some of the things that people are coming out with on both sides was actually quite worrying. And funnily enough, the UKIP candidate that won in his acceptance speech this morning talked about freedom. The SNP uses this word a lot as well. Freedom. I don't think we really understand what that word means. And if you talk to Americans, particularly in the Republican Party, is that they're always talking about freedom. Freedom to do what? And, you know, that's what's really worrying. And freedom from what? And I question that whole area. So localism and the political manifestations of Bretons wanting to break away, the Welsh wanting to do this and so on, is that we're beginning to lose some of our understanding of internationalism.
And so you talked a little bit about European models as perhaps preference to the US. What is attractive about the European?
Well, there's something called the social solidarity economy, which I've only recently come across, and it's close to what I've I mean by social enterprise. It's much more about solidarity. And in Europe, that has a particular, and particularly in French, has a particular meaning, which is around the collective rather than the individual. But because the French speak in French and we speak in English, and we've always been suspicious of each other, is that we haven't shared enough of experiences around that. That's what's kind of interesting going to Canada. I'm supposed to be going to Canada in February with the mob from the UNICEF Centre, because they've got a stronger understanding of French social solidarity economy in Canada than and it's not really reached the States. And it's where identity is, you know, is local and community and mutual support and more social capital type things around reciprocity and understanding and responsibilities to the collective rather than responsibilities only to the individual and how much you own.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of initiatives are happening in France that you think are particularly
There's something called PACTS, which I'm sort of vaguely associated with. I can't remember what exactly it stands for. But they've been a partner in a European project I've been involved in the last 2 years. And it's quite an interesting project. You wander around from place to place and you learn more about what other people are doing. And I'm particularly interested in how they have that kind of commune mentality in France. Social responsibility at an individual and a collective level to the wider whole and not just competing with each other. We've got to, as a society, to get away from believing that competition is always good into, at times, collaboration and cooperation are going to be of better benefit or more benefit. And competition has done lots of interesting good things and development of things like that and, you know, sort of technology, but it's not always the way to fashion a society that is more equitable and more have more social responsibility to those that are not quite as well as off as others.
So do you feel optimistic about the future of social enterprise?
Well, again, I think there'll be a split of social enterprise. I think that some people will go down the route that I've been sort of espousing, and other people will just say, oh yeah, everything's a social enterprise. And so what will happen is a kind of degrading of the term social enterprise, and particularly when there's no definition. So it will just go wander off and everybody will laugh at social enterprise and think, well, that was the cul-de-sac that went down, and somebody will invent something else. The solidarity economy or something. And but there's no getting away from, if you can get people to work together to help each other and the wider community and have a responsibility to the most vulnerable in society, that's what people should be doing with their lives.
I don't have any further questions, but is there anything else you'd like to mention?
No, you're probably exhausted enough from me.
Or did you have any questions for me?
I think this project, this historical aspect, is particularly crucial. But not as an academic exercise. If you see what I mean? It's all very well just, you know, writing up history, but history quite often goes into the confines of a shelf, saying, "Oh yeah, that's it over there." But it's got to be brought into the present, and that's why the link between you and Bobby's work is kind of really important. But I'm not sure that he's really recognised that yet. And I'm not sure. I don't know either your work or his work well enough. But and I think when it gets into into the kind of case studies and that kind of work is that I think a lot of the benefits will be the connections that you and your project make with Bobby's project and the project Bobby's project with the other people that are employed. It's not to focus on the content of what you do, it's to focus on the connections. Now that looks, that sounds kind of esoteric and a little bit sort of impossible, but that's what I think, and that's why in some ways I think that the Knowledge Exchange Forum has up till now been more of a kind of showcase to others, and that's all very well because of the stage this project's at, but I think it should be much more working, people working together across the different projects, coming together with people from the projects, not just the researcher, but to exchange ideas and cross-fertilize. And then I think things will really, the sum of the whole will be more important than the individual particular things. And I'm not sure that's going to happen. But we will see.
We'll see indeed. Thank you very much.
That's not meant as a criticism, though. It's just...